We are then now going to reconvene. Thank you, honorable members and members of the department. We will then take questions on the presentation that has just been given. Anyone, honorable Smith?
Yeah, thanks very much, Chair, and thanks to Mr. Sachse for the presentation. I think it's quite very interesting. Maybe just as a starting point, I know this is a grand challenge dealing with climate change, not energy, but presumably the two speak to each other very closely. And I didn't see anything indicating the overlap. Now, I don't know whether there's a very rigid compartmentalization between the challenges or not, because, I mean, it's difficult for me to talk about climate change without talking about carbon economy and lowering the carbon footprint. There isn't a word said about that anywhere in the presentation. I presume it's because it's covered under the energy grand challenge, but is that the case? I mean, issues to do with, you know, lower emissions and all the rest of it. I mean, even that slide, for example, on page 4, which is talking about the programmatic, you know, reducing human footprint, you know, waste minimization, biodiversity, etc. I mean, lowering carbon footprint, you know, unless there's some sort of unified multi-grand challenge which includes all these things. So that's the first issue. Then I wanted to... Oh, then the Atlas. I think the Atlas is absolutely marvelous. I'm very impressed with it. But just two questions arise. First of all, I presume from a municipality point of view, since you say it's municipal-based, you drill down to the individual municipality level, and then all the information that's put into your municipality presumably would be there, maybe with a broader context as well. But then I wanted to ask, you know, there are many challenges. I see, for example, one of the slides talks about, if you look at the things that are highlighted in the Atlas, you'd have things like air quality emissions, health. Now, if you're a municipality in Mpumalanga and you had serious respiratory diseases to deal with and you had serious acid rain to deal with as a result of, you know, our coal power stations, the fact that the Atlas tells you that, there's not much you can do about it because it's a national policy issue that's resulted in your having to live with these consequences. So I'm just wondering to what extent the Atlas actually empowers the municipality to do anything. What does it empower it to do, given that its problems may be externalized? Then the issue of, I think the big issue for me really is the link between policy and science. And I was very interested in this bureau of yours. I think it's grand. You made a passing comment at the end that, of course, if we were to fund you better, you know, all these things, so things would work better. But I noticed in the press a couple of days ago that if you look at all our R&D expenditure, we're down on our national target again, of course, not 1.5%, even on the 1% we're down. And the underspender was the science councils. Because the private sector was up in real terms, higher education was up in real terms, the science councils were down. Now, I don't know where this bureau would fit in terms of this those bodies doing the research, but if it's clustered in the sort of science council grouping, then obviously there's a trend there which says even if you give them money, they can't spend it, as opposed to the universities and so on. So that's my first issue. Where are you in that one? And then the second issue linked to the bureau is, it's good, I think, to bring science and policy together, but is there any danger that government doesn't really want to hear the sad truth out there? In other words, the science can reveal things that nobody really wants to touch. The sleeping dogs lie. You know, like, we don't have scrubbers on our power stations. Why? Because they cost a lot of money, so we just let them emit forever. We have mercury emissions. Nobody wants to touch the issue of mercury emissions from coal stations. You know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, will the science talking to policy actually produce change to policy? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Nongonye. Before that, let's welcome the chair. And I've forgotten now, you know, this thing of when you're given power, it's very difficult to let it go. But, there's a term in our province in Xhosa that says, power is it's something that you can't just let it go. If you have been given, you must hold tight on it, but welcome, and I'm handing over to you. We were on questions in the first presentation, so it's your.
Thank you very much, Honorable Whip of Committee. Just a word of apology. We have just been, I don't know what has happened on N2, but we're just, because we're not moving, we're to turn back and go and get into N1. And that's why I'm a bit late. But I did say that she must carry on and apologize on my behalf. Yeah. But I think just carry on where you have ended.
Honourable Nkunya.
Yeah, Chair and Honourable Members and DG and the delegation, good morning. Well, first of all, thank you for this presentation, Mr. Patel and your colleagues. To me, on this, it's really not much, but I noticed some notable progress. In that bullet number 4, you said call issued for the establishment of risk and vulnerability service centers at Rural University. I read that perhaps there are some notable progress there. Whether it is a calling or the actual establishment of these service centers, that is the purpose of my clarity-seeking question. And I also noticed later on in your presentation under R&V service centers, yes, you reiterate what I support, the targeted the rural university, the target of the rural university. And you then said the maximum of 500 to be established over the next 18 to 24 months. So I would like to know, are you able to share with us which rural universities in the country are these centers having been established, if at all? If not, those that it is envisaged will be established in the 18 to 24 months, as is suggested in the other slide. That's the only thing at this stage you can share.
I can see there are no other questions except one from myself, which I'm covered with the others. In the light of the state of our municipalities, are you, in terms of their capacity, who will then monitor the rural, I'm sorry, the municipalities and the issues of waste management. I'm asking that, and I've got a, which I'm subject to correction, I've got a belief, maybe they differ from one municipality to another, but I don't think our municipalities have got a clue on waste management. I don't think they've got a clue of a number of things that can be generated from waste, energy, you name them. Now, as I know it may not be your core business or your mandate to, but who monitors, obviously assisted by you, if I'm correct, by the Department of Science and Technology on that. But basically for me, and if there is no capacity, how best do you think that they can be assisted?
Thanks, Chair, the new Chair and the old Chair. Let me start backwards in terms of the questions. On waste management, there is, in fact, a two-day conference at the moment led by the Department of Environmental Affairs that's looking at the reduction of our landfill sites, and they've invited the municipalities, etc. So I think the way I see that unfolding is that as part of the outcomes approach of government, there's a outcome 10 that looks at improving natural assets, etc. And one of the specific areas is to reduce the size of our landfill sites. And what municipalities are doing is they are being asked to indicate what are their contributions to that. So that's one way of managing it. However, I don't think it's a simple answer. Most of the challenges around that kind of waste management, when you're talking about residential waste, is not necessarily in the technology. There are some technology elements, but it's more getting some of your bylaws and that in place. See, for example, do you require people to separate their waste like other countries do? Do you then, for example, provide subsidies for people to recycle? And those obviously are going to be taken up. So I think when municipalities are dealing with many challenges, waste may not be necessarily on the top of the agenda, but I think there's a consciousness now that we need to do more waste. Some of the areas of waste that we would be interested in as DST is there are opportunities in non-residential waste that are quite significant. I mean, there's a whole stream of industrial waste that we need to be thinking about. Or if you're looking at electronic waste, you know, we just, every day there's new cell phones coming, there's problems. And there are a big technology development opportunity in that. So the answer around waste management is I don't think there's anybody who's able to monitor municipalities. The best you can do is support municipalities and their abilities to do this. And I know many, many instances where people have done this, for example, by supporting community-based separation and collection and what our colleagues from cooperative governance are doing by creating a learning network is their case. I know DBSA is trying to assist, et cetera. So hopefully some of these will lead to more waste management happening in the country. In terms of the risk and vulnerability service centers, you're right that the issue that we've done is we've issued the call. We need to have a fair process around these establishments. So what we've done is we've issued the call, a call for interest. And depending which universities have indicated an interest, like I said, it excludes your big universities, your Wits and the UCTs, etc. So it's been targeted at Limpopo and Fort Hare, etc. Based on what kind of response we get to our request for interest, we will then work with those universities to design these service centers. So we won't do it on our own. We will work with them, and that's going to happen. We have another model where we've done this called the Community University Partnership Program, and we're using the same methodology. So the call has been issued. In 2 weeks' time, we would have a workshop with those universities that have expressed an interest, and I know from engagements with Venda, with Limpopo, with Northwest, they are keen, and Fort Hare as well, would come in, and then we would work with them to say what is it that would be required. We also have interest from a donor agency who's willing to support some of this. So the idea would be to set up full, you know, whether it's the facilities, the computer facilities, etc., to access the Atlas and then to use it. But our interest is mainly in terms of the people's development, to be able to develop, and that's why we need to engage with the universities, because if they don't have an existing program that can provide the feeder into a master's level program on risk and vulnerability, we need to create that. So it depends on the universities, but I know, for example, Limpopo has just recently initiated some very strong work around this. So the call has been issued, and then over the next 18 months, we would launch them as they are ready to be launched. And like I said, we're targeting like your Fort Hare, Limpopo, Venda, Northwest, Mafeking campus, etc. Some of the Honourable Member Smith's questions around the link between the global change and the energy. The energy grand challenge, the focus is very much on the technology development side. If you look at what is being looked at, we're looking at renewable energies, hydrogen, etc. So it has a very strong technology component. When you're talking about creating a low-carbon economy, it's both the technology but a whole set of other issues on the policy side, on the regulation side, etc. So we have and are working very closely together around that. There'll be a technology development angle, and we think that as a Department of Science and Technology, we have a a big contribution to make to influence the debate. Because sometimes the debate around what kind of energy mix we should be choosing in the future is influenced by what is available technologically. And we would be able to come and say on the technological side, you know, it is possible to have a greater contribution to wind, etc. But if you looked at the global change grand challenge, those diagrams, there's two: adapting the way we live and innovation for sustainability. Because the low carbon economy thing is also loaded politically internationally. Internationally, the big debate is around the contribution of individual countries to reduce emissions generally. As South Africa, we are saying, as a developing country, we were not the big cause of that problem in the past. So we need to think about this carefully, and by having too much a focus on emissions, you fall into the political trap of taking liability for a problem that you shouldn't. South Africa, on its for its own sake, has taken a decision, and people know this from our environmental colleagues. We've and President Zuma made the commitment that we will peak and decline. So that's very strong. Now, what we're saying is, as a science and technology ministry, how do we aid that peak and decline model, both in terms of the energy grand challenge, but also the softer science? So it's happening in some ways. There's no artificial walls between the grand challenges. This grand challenge, in fact, interfaces with the human and social dynamics grand challenge. When we look at understanding a changing planet, it interfaces with the social, with the space grand challenge around observation, etc. So as a department, we're conscious of these links and have pulled it together. When the issue is that as a Department of Science and Technology, we can provide tools and techniques and methodologies that can support improved decision making. So we have a focus on decision support systems in DSD, and that's what we fund. Whether these decision support systems are most effectively used, that's beyond our control in some way. But we don't take the approach of saying it's not our problem. We can develop the risk and vulnerability atlas, but if municipalities don't use it, then it's not our business. We don't use that approach, but obviously our influence becomes more limited in that instance. What we have done in the case of the risk and vulnerability atlas is we're partnering with the Development Bank of South Africa. They have their Vulindlela Academy, and we're looking at a 5-day training program targeted at engineers, etc., to say, here's the power of information and what you can do with better information. But we also look at causes that are targeted in municipal managers, which would expose them. So we have a very strong, but we need to grow this partnership with the Development Bank of South Africa. But we're also directly engaging with municipalities. We have a user community that we've built around the Atlas. And that user community will work with us to further strengthen and develop. As a science and technology ministry, I think that's the best you can do. Make available the tools, create the structures to enable it, but whether people use it may require something else. If it grows and it becomes a useful tool, you know, our colleagues in cooperative governance can make decisions that you have to use it. But you're right, some of the problems are external. But, I mean, that goes with any decision support. We're looking at what is within their control. A big area would be infrastructure planning. If you're planning your own infrastructure, your own roads, if you're thinking of dams or whatever, then the Atlas can be useful. But if it's a cross-border pollution cloud that's coming, there's not much you can do. However, it might empower you to engage with your province, etc. So, like we say, information is power, and that's what we're doing. We're making available information in a powerful way, and we'll see what gets done with the politics. The last question around science and policy, I mean, and then your science councils in terms of down, I'm not too sure about that. We can check. I haven't seen those figures. But the thing about R&D expenditure in this field in some way is that there are now opportunities emerging where we can. And it's not as if the Bureau will sit with the... In fact, the DST will champion the Bureau. The Bureau would inform us as DST on where we should be investing in. but it doesn't take away that responsibility, because ultimately it's the DST that will have to make the sub-budget submissions to the MTF, etc. We will be guided by what is coming out from the Bureau in our arguments, but it's not as if we're going to create a structure that's going to now suddenly, you know, that remains with the Department. It's the primary responsibility of the Department to go and use the annual budget cycles to try to win. But by having a Bureau, it strengthens our case, because it provides us with a clear sense that this kind of research is useful, and it has some backing in terms of, and in that Bureau there might be members of this portfolio committee that sits on there, etc. It helps to create a much better system for ourselves. And then the science policy question, I mean, that's not a unique South African problem. All over the world. In fact, South Africa is looked at as quite pioneering. I mean, our water policy as an example is held up worldwide as a case where science really informed policy. I mean, I'm doing my personal studies around science policy interfaces. And the same problems we hear here is happening in Europe, it's happening in the US, etc. You know, researchers complaining that stuff is not going through, etc. And I think it's not a science question, it's a governance question. And I think as South Africa, we are taking some steps. I mean, the concept of the National Planning Commission is exactly that, is to use better science to make better choices. But politics will always come into science. Even though I think science is important, science has to be merged with politics and other questions to come up with decision-making. So it's not a challenge that will be easily addressed, and I think it's a challenge that will remain as long as we have science and politics. But I think we're making efforts to try to bridge that gap between science and policy. Thanks. Thanks, Chair.
Well, I'm new. I'm sorry. I may be out of order. I don't know. Maybe it's because I had you saying something about Atlas. Were you talking about the Wind Atlas?
No. The Risk and Vulnerability Atlas. There's a Solar Atlas and there's a Wind Atlas, and they... different, there's a carbon capture and storage atlas, they're all at,
But I just wanted to your opinion from our undertaking, which I have just partly touched, our submission in Copenhagen of 43%, was it not over ambitious?
It depends where you come from in terms of this, yeah. No, I think if you read the politics, it's a kind of commitment that it's been modeled on the long-term mitigation scenario, so it's possible. It's possible, taking into account a lot of issues, and that's what we need to be focusing on.
Excuse me, that one, if I remember very well, is not a long-term issue, it's a 2020 issue.
Yeah, 2025.
Yeah, which is actually a short-term in terms of the time frames of climate,
yes.
The negotiations. It's a short-term issue. It's not a long-term issue.
The 43% number is on what they call the business-as-usual scenario. So South Africa's emissions will increase. We can't get away from that over the next 20 years. Our emissions will increase. But when government did the modeling with researchers, they identified what it would have risen by and said that we would look at cutting that down by 43%, depending on what we would have emitted anyway. So it is an ambitious target, but I think all targets, if they're not ambitious, they don't force creative thinking. And we are working with our colleagues in the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, and people are looking at this from the context of your energy mix debates, etc. How do we get to that target? So it's very difficult. It's not an easy answer for anyone to say, how are we going to be able to achieve this? Even the government targets internationally are not certain. They're difficult, and I think South Africa, to its credit, has taken on made a very bold commitment. But that bold commitment now needs a variety of role players to all work together to do that. It's in our long-term interest, in our children's interest, to try to do that. What it means in practice, I think there's a lot more work being done now to say, what does it actually mean? You know, how much renewable energies would we need to have to bring into the system? You know, how do we change our wind energy, etc.? And that's why we on the science and technology front are building the technology basis to enable targets like that to be met. So it's not an easy answer, and I'm trying to be, to not say beyond what's my mandate. To comment on these targets is the stuff.
You see, it's not an easy answer for you, but it's a very easy observation for every Tom, Dick, and Harry that it's very overambitious. But if you are a scientist, it's even disturbing because. In science we try to seek out facts. We don't rely on theories. We rely on facts of research findings. Now sometimes just at an inspection level before research. If you are a person of science, it becomes very difficult to imagine if South Africa has a build program of 387 billion on fossil-based, by the way, up to 2017, and then to expect that in the same period. It will also be reducing emissions by 43% to meet the on, because after 2017, it's just 3 years to 2020.
No, but our emissions won't decrease. If you read the scenarios, our emissions will increase. But when the modeling was done as part of the long-term mitigation scenarios, you said if you take today and you look at 2020, our emissions will increase fourfold. So we're going to see an increase in our emissions. What the 43% is to say, based on that fourfold increase, we can reduce that by 43%. It's this concept in climate change negotiations called business as usual. If we continue the way we continue, we will emit more. And the idea is we'll emit four times more than what we're emitting now. So we're cutting down 43% on four times. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not mathematics. I don't know if there's any mathematician, but it's. So the idea is that we would increase our emissions less than we would have ideally, and that's where there's a lot of debates. The IRP has not been finalized. The IEP has not been finalized, and those are part of the debates that people are looking at the contributions of different. But these are the kind of debates that I think are happening even within the portfolio committee. From a science and technology front, we think that it gives us a very good opportunity. An ambitious target gives an opportunity to develop technology. And we have prioritized, if you look at the energy grand challenge, there's a very strong focus on alternative energies, on renewable energies, on clean coal technologies. So it stimulates that. By having an ambitious target, and Treasury is looking at the carbon tax, it stimulates development of renewable energies. So if I'm thinking of Department of Science and Technology, if I'm thinking of the technology aspect, an ambitious target is very good for the science system because we can become world leaders in renewable solar technologies or wind technologies, etc., using our own domestic requirements as a base. So that's why I say it depends on which perspective you're looking at, and it's something we're going to have to monitor. But from a science and technology perspective, we've come to the party by saying we can build the kind of research and technology development capacities that would allow us to meet such an ambitious target.
Politically, it's dangerous. It is politically dangerous. you don't go to international platforms like this, and actually play around what may be politically possible ransom when they hold you at ransom. So it's politically dangerous. U.S. would have said so. They came with only 17%, you see, and so forth. But it's fine. But I'm talking from the position of because I come from those platforms, you see. At international level, I know how dangerous it is politically, where we are involved. But it's fine if you think that you were playing a technology game. It's a technology game which is politically dangerous. You see? That's fine. Anyway, I think I don't know if the whip must continue because I'm not sure where we were.
No, thank you, Che. We will then request Mr. Stephen Matsatsi, yes, to give us the next presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, also let me apologize for arriving late. I'll give a presentation on the Centers of Competence program that the department has initiated. Just to introduce myself, once again, Stephen Razazi, I'm the Chief Director responsible for innovation planning and instruments in the department. So, overview of the presentation, we'll just give you a little bit of background and conceptualization issues. We'll look at the Centers of Excellence as an instrument as well as Centers of Competence. Characteristics of Centers of Competence, or COCs, features, models, and then we'll look at the benefits for, or envisaged benefits for industry and academia that participate in COCs. Current status, highlights and challenges, and we'll touch a little bit on titanium COC just to present that as an example of, because most of this is theoretical, so I think the case study will just demonstrate the concept in terms of what we are trying to do. What is a COC, or Centers of Competence? Firstly, we say it should be a collaborative partnership for technology development. It should involve industry, higher education institutions, and science councils, and then, of course, with government support, like what the department is currently doing, you know, supporting all these particular players to be able to come together and develop technologies together. It is typically high risk, and it takes a long-term approach to research in order to increase both local and global competitiveness and the ability to launch new technologies in the market. And the main aim is technology commercialization. So in our environment, you'll find that the emphasis is always on COCs working on a technology that can end up with some sort of either economic or social impact outcome. In the system, you'll find that there's currently what we call Centers of Competence and Centers of Excellence, COEs. So this tends to create some form of confusion because some people have seen the same concept in other countries overseas. And basically what happens from, it varies from country to country in terms of where these two are positioned. So what we call a COC may be regarded in another country as a COE and vice versa. But for our sake, we try to differentiate them along these lines that COCs would be those that are industry-led and focus on development of near-market technologies with explicit objective for technology commercialization, whereas COCs will be university-led, focus on fundamental research with explicit objective to produce new knowledge discovery. So that is just how we differentiate between the two concepts. Characteristics of a COC, you'll find that there should be or there is a pooling of existing research capabilities. And what this means is we are aware that there's research and development currently taking place, be it at universities or research councils or industry. In some instances, you find that some of these institutions are working on more or less the same concept, develop capabilities, in some instances patents, that on their own they don't progress towards commercialization, because typically what happens in technology commercialization is not only one patent that is able to progress into the market on its own. It requires complementary technologies that can enable it to go to the market. So you find there's always capabilities that are lying all over the place that are not being harnessed. Pooling of resources such as funding, human resources, infrastructure, laboratories, and so on. Platform for new contractual and institutional relationships by way of increasing industry academic partnerships. Because eventually what happens, you'll find that industry continues to use technologies from elsewhere, things that are ready and proven to work, and it's difficult for local industry to work with our local universities. So you want to make an improvement on that score. Infrastructure and human capital development, and then long-term partnerships leading to R&D licensing and or commercialization. I know DG will reprimand this because it's not clear. Firstly, apologies, you know, it's not so clear. But what we are trying to say here is basically the challenge between academic and industry relationship is basically based on the fact that naturally you find that industry tends to be more driven by profit motives, opportunity-driven, and low risk. So industry tends to, the point is also not so powerful. Industry tends to operate more towards the left, I mean the right of the graph, you know, where you can see immediate opportunities, technology is proven, has been researched elsewhere, and you can actually launch it. So the time to market is not a big problem. Whereas academia, on the other hand, will then tend to operate in the space that is knowledge-driven and strive for academic excellence. So between the two, you have a natural disparity in the entire relationship. So what we find is that on the side of the academia, yes, there is a research and development and intellectual property capabilities and the production of human resources, and for lack of a better word, human resources that you can almost call raw, as in you have a PhD or a science background or engineering background, but you don't quite have the practical industry experience. Whereas industry, on the other hand, will basically have knowledge of the market, access to the market, production capabilities, access to the suppliers and networks in that regard, as well as experienced and trained human capital. So at the end of the day, you find that industry doesn't quite understand, you know, what the science scientists or what the science is doing. And also the academic side doesn't have a sense of which technologies or where markets are going, you know, in the next foreseeable future, to be able to focus on those industries that address market needs and that can be uptaken at some point. So that is a disparity between the relationship. So the COC program is basically trying to come in the middle and try to pull both industry and academia together so that, you know, the two can basically work towards the same end goal. You have various approaches that COCs can be formed, and it can be a deliberate top-down process which is based on policy and national priorities. I can just give examples here. For instance, if one of the government priorities is to develop vaccine capabilities, you can have, from a policy point of view, you know, a priority around developing a COC or establishing a COC around vaccine development. Same applies in some instances where we have a natural resource that we are not harnessing economic activity or economic benefit out of it, as we'll see later in the titanium COC case study. So you can have out of priorities or policy priorities an establishment of a COC. Alternatively, you can have an open process or competitive process, but I like to limit a little bit on the competitive, because the idea is to mine all forms of capabilities from wherever that they could be sitting to try and harness them and bring them together to move towards a specific commercialization goal, which is, again, linked to national requirements and then as well as consortium strength. So in other words, a group of different players coming together and saying that these are our strengths in this particular technology. And then, of course, bottom-up initiatives based on the strength of research consortia. So this particular program allows the various parties to can even interact together and identify different capabilities that are sitting all over the show, and, you know, to be able to come together and form a COC.
Why you said this is a kind of friend of the study? Why did you not even put the program this time?
Okay, thanks for that. We'll change in the next presentation. Okay. With our analysis of the national system of innovation, we found that, you know, much as competencies can exist, in some instances you'll find that the parties know exactly that if we combine this capability and that patent and this, you know, research program, we can actually work towards manufacturing or production or commercialization of a specific technology. So this will then represent different capabilities sitting in like CSIR or MRC or University of Venda or FEDS or whatever the case may be, to say let's come together, but we identify a specific technology that we want to work towards. So we bring together the capabilities, combine them with production methods and integration capabilities, and this is mostly the role of industry as well as market requirements to work towards a particular goal. So this is fairly interesting and straightforward. But then you can also have a situation where, you know, some research has been done in UCT, and on its own, it doesn't really mean anything. And you find that for it to be fully developed to a point where it can begin to translate into something, you know, there's still a gap that needs to be filled, maybe 3, 4, 5 years of doing further research. But you can also find that the similar research programs that have been funded elsewhere throughout the system. So this program also allows for such parties to actually come together and identify the capabilities that are there, maybe existing patents or a group of students or researchers that have been produced in that particular area to say, can we progress this research, close the gaps, and get to a point where we can sort of define the technology that we want to commercialize or launch. Pretty much, you know, the same sort of argument to say we can come, the program can support the coming together of these parties who have some sort of capabilities and gaps to allow them to work together until a point where they can identify potential products. In some instances, you know, you can create a platform that brings together different capabilities that may spin off a range of technologies. So here the platform is actually the center of competence that actually spins, you know, technologies along the lines of medical or electronics or communications technology, whatever the case may be. And this will be further explained in the case study that we have. As I said, most of this is more theoretical, but the case study will then try to explain what we are trying to achieve. Benefits for participating in the COCs, in this case for industry, opportunity to engage in higher risk, long-term development of products and services, because we've identified that it's easy for industry to just focus on those things that are, you know, that have potential to make money today. So, and not engaging in long-term research. And over the time in South Africa, you find that this is how most of our industries fall by the wayside, because, you know, you stick to what you know today, what exists, what works. But over the years, you find that you're becoming more and more uncompetitive. You know, you can make a lot of cases around textiles industry, although there are other, you know, factors that affected it. But also from a technology point of view, you find that other countries tend to move towards faster, simpler, easier, quicker, and cheaper methods of production. You know, that's becoming more and more competitive. So you want to be able to bring in industry to focus on R&D and, you know, those technological developments that will in future affect their business. Direct input into the strategic direction of the COC. This is important because industry can be able to say to research groups from the start that, you know, the market doesn't require this, or we're seeing more and more that the market is moving away from using this material into lighter materials because of the following reasons. So maybe let's not waste time, money, and resources on a specific COC, rather focus on developing an alternative technology. So it's quite important that industry participates in the COCs. And then access to intellectual property and influence on its exploitation. If industry parties are participating in a particular COC, they'll then be able to access the intellectual property that comes out of there, either by way of licenses or preferential usage in certain markets of that IP. Networking with opportunities for involvement in other R&D initiatives and appropriate fit with commercialization culture. So you want a blend of all this particular characteristics to influence the choice of COCs. Benefits to universities and research institutions, dynamic interaction with industry to ensure R&D will deliver economic benefits. So it's not only research for the sake of research, but there should be research for that will lead to some form of socio-economic benefits. Long-term funding mechanism allowing time to bring R&D to fruition. And, I mean, we know that, for instance, if you talk about a laptop like this, you'll find that there's more than 100 licenses of various technologies or different technology suppliers in what we see as an end product, as a laptop, that have gone into this. So you want to be able to enable those individual capabilities or patents to come to fruition. Possibility to spin out new commercial entities and exploit IP, not just create it, and then access to larger streams of funding. It's a very busy slide, and firstly, I want to apologize for that. But we just wanted to show here where centers of competence are positioned in the entire national system of innovation. So if you assume a linear progression from basic research to applied research, technology development, transfer and production, and, you know, looking at the currently the national system of innovation, who are the players in this particular space of basic research, and NRF will actually come as one of the ones, as well as the DST, of course. And out of that environment of basic research, you find that the publications and the creation of new knowledge is quite important. And this is where we see the role or the position of COEs, centers of excellence. So we don't want to come with a with clashing programs. So you want the COEs to continue to exist, because that's where you're going to crack the next form of knowledge, or the next form of publication or whatever science that can come out of that. But at the same time, you want a seamless progression of that particular science into an environment where it can be further developed and transformed to an extent that it can actually move more towards commercialization. So as the space evolves, or as the innovation chain evolves, you'll find that from basic research to applied research, the DST and the NRF is still, you know, the major players there. And as you move more towards technology development and the other side, which is more transfer and production, you begin to bring in other parties, and the outcomes that you'll generate there will be patents and new products and new services, and basically that's where the COCs will sit.
You know, your presentation can be very good, but if you have not mastered the colors on your PowerPoint, actually at international conferences, you look many points needed by virtue of the colors, because you can't see anything here. I'm very close here, but I can't even see it here.
Apologies and point taken. We will try and make an improvement. We'll actually try and test before we can just come and present. DJ has already raised this, actually.
One member here, Professor Muhammad, he was very much affected by colors. He was very affected by colors.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. But okay. National Intellectual Property Management Office. This is the administrative body that is established in terms of the Intellectual Property Rights Act. Intellectual property rights from publicly financed research and development. And basically, the NIPMO allows the whole NSI to manage intellectual property, you know, whether it's in this area of basic research, or it's in the area of technology development, or it's really in the state of commercialization and licensing and all of those things. So basically, what the slide is trying to do is to show us where the COCs are positioned, but we are arguing for a seamless progression from whether it's basic research and knowledge into COCs towards commercialization. And you see that different players
should and will have to take to take role as the president. So this is where it's talking of applied research now, the role of DST and NRF, and really when you move into technology development, you know, you're looking still at DST as a government department responsible, but really the space of the TIA, Technology Innovation Agency, venture capital players, as well as programs, DTI programs, such as the SPI, strategic program for industrial innovation. And then when you move into transfer and production, the space of the DTI instruments, such as industrial development corporation, venture capital, private equity players, and so on. So the COCs basically try to harness those research capabilities that are sitting in different players, different stages, and see we can bring them together to develop new technologies that can be commercialized.
COCs can take different forms. It can be physical or virtual platform, establishes collaborative environments between government, industry, higher education, and science councils. Unlike a situation where everyone is working in their own direction, you know, government policies don't talk to the science that's happening on the ground. The industry is not using the science that is being produced out of universities and so on. And universities produce science that, you know, doesn't go anywhere at the end of the day. So you want to have that kind of collaborative environment. And it's also a wastage if, you know, we continue to support research that is not talking to or, you know, relating to any, whether it's government policy or what industry or the market requires, not only local market but also international market, or some of our social problems that we're facing in the society. So this program also tries to streamline all those issues. Provide secure and even contractual basis for relationship between the parties. And I think we've emphasized this, you know, the objective to commercialize or bring into the market new technologies. Once again, if you allow me, Chair, just to explain the color. You'll find that what you want to be able to bring in the COC is capabilities, but those capabilities can manifest in different forms. So you have knowledge of the market, as I said. You can have infrastructure, research laboratories. You can have people and particular teams. You can have patents. Some can have funds. Business concept to say, if I tweak this and take that technology and mix with this, maybe I can, you know, go into that market. And so you want, and this you'll typically find sitting in maybe CSR has done farm research. Let's maybe another investor has done some knowledge, you know, they've published something on that particular technology, but let's do that. So you want to be able to harness all of that, bring it into a center of competence, which is really a structure that is or have characteristics of somewhat being semi-independent, has a dedicated management team that will actually coordinate and be able to pull all these things together. And it acts as a commercialization hub for that particular technology. You can also have advisors around intellectual property management, licensing, and so on, technology transfer, because these are normally specialist areas, and some of these you can actually bring in from the National Intellectual Property Management Office, people that help with market analysis, business development, and so on, contributing to the COC, because you actually want to be able to pull all those things and make something out of it. And then funding, the policy support, and where required, you can bring in international collaborators, provided, you know, they've got synergies that they can bring into the COC. And the underlying factor or the driving factor is always market opportunity or social challenges. So if you're focusing on, or market opportunity can also result out of the country's or prevalence of certain natural resources in the country, or
you know, certain challenges and social challenges and so on.
We also ask by the portfolio committee to touch a little bit on some of the challenges facing the COC program. Firstly, I should explain that it's actually a new program that the DST is championing. So we're still trying to perfect the whole framework and how it will be implemented. But what we've seen so far with the ones that we started is that sometimes, you know, there is intellectual property, but maybe it's not at the point where it needs to be particularly suitable for commercialization on the identified technology. It's difficult to get industry interested, and this is something that we think we need to put more work in terms of bringing industry. Universities are the easiest to come on board. I don't know if it's because of the funding potential or what, but, you know, one would like to believe that it's based on the research capabilities and patents that have been created. And naturally, I mean, the COCs are positioned in a high-risk space where basically nobody goes, because industry, like I showed in the previous graph, they're interested more in current opportunities, profits, and so on, while, you know, universities are doing basic research. So you find that COCs find themselves in the middle, and basically nobody wants to go there, you know, by way of investing, you know. And now we've put the tier in place and forming appropriate partnerships with other funding agencies, hopefully, to address that particular space. And, I mean, with industry, it's difficult to interest them, because once they ask you what is time to market, and they say maybe 5 years, 10 years, 12 years, they just step away. But if time to market is tomorrow, obviously, they are interested. Unclear commercialization strategies may discourage industry. Okay, I've already explained this. Establishment process from concept formation to feasibility studies, business planning, and you know, the actual sign-off of COC agreement may be too long, because we need to do a lot of due diligence on the claims that will be coming from various parties, you know, to make sure that you're not just bringing any claim of R&D capability into a COC, because at the end of the day, you'll discourage members that are serious about the business. So that time may be too long and may be, you know, seen as a deterrent in some instances. Then the quantum of funds required to leap from knowledge to prototypes, testing, and pilot production often huge, and not many players in this space are interested to come in. So it's a big problem, and it's an area of concern. But at the end of the day, we want to see how COCs as a modality can try and address some of these challenges. And then we've also asked to look at the current status of some of the COCs that are in place around space science or the Space Green Challenge. We have most of the COCs there, synthetic aperture radar, and so on and so forth, being at concept stage. Hopefully in the next 6 months, if we are invited again to report, maybe there will be an update or progress in terms of the establishment of those COCs. In advanced manufacturing, you have natural fiber-reinforced composite, which is operational and funded. I think this is a program that started with an identification of a market opportunity with Airbus Industries, and it involves a range of players here, CSIR and other universities. Perhaps if there are questions around this, maybe my colleague Imran can help me, because he's championing that particular COC. Again, microsensors, unmanned aerial vehicle, I think these ones are still being formed. I believe by now there should be a business plan for the UAV COC. The hydrogen and fuel cells COC, those are operational and funded. You'll recall that the hydrogen and fuel cells COCs are based on the existence of platinum raw material in the country. And as South Africa, you want to be you know, the first, or you want to be ahead of the pack in terms of platinum-related downstream industries. So hydrogen and fuel cells were seen as one of the prime platinum-based industries of the future. So we have established COCs around hydrogen infrastructure or hydrogen energy infrastructure and distribution and so on and so forth. The titanium COC will actually see a case study, so maybe it's best for me not to go into detail on that particular one. So you can see a range of areas: space, advanced manufacturing, hydrogen fuel cells, titanium, human health and biotechnology, medical devices, and most of these ones in the human health, these are still currently platforms. Some of them are still at basic research or by way of COEs that will later on be graduated into COCs. And the same applies to the medical device, you know, COCs. Some of them are still finalizing the basic research and in that stage where they will later be graduated into COCs. Nanotechnology is also one area that the department is focusing specifically on mineral beneficiation and advanced materials using nanotechnology. And those are really at concept stage. And then we also have COCs in fluorochemicals. And again, this is driven by the fact that South Africa has, or is one of the countries around the world with fluorochemical as a raw material. But we're not quite adding value that we should be adding to harness all the economic benefits out of fluorochemicals. So we then formed the COC in that area. And most of the ICT COCs are being developed at the moment. Successes. On the hydrogen and fuel cells, there's already a number of patents and or products. And the medical device COC, one of the products got a CE marking out of that COC. I've spoken about the challenges, basically, in the previous slide. This is the hydrogen-powered bicycle prototype, so it's an outcome of this particular COC. So we're already testing the technology by way of this product. So that was just to give you a sense. I think now we'll go to the titanium COC case study just to be able to put more of the theoretical stuff into a concrete example.
Thanks, Chair. In this case study, we recognized that on the left-hand side, South Africa has significant titanium ore reserves, which is a raw material. And on the right-hand side, we recognize that titanium is constantly being utilized in a number of sectors, in the aerospace industry, automotive, and medical and recreational industries, where there is a new product on the market in the aerospace called Dreamliner by Boeing. 18% of the material that is in that aircraft is titanium, and the advantage of titanium is that it's a strong material but very, very light, and therefore you can have the same strength that you need, but you can save fuel quite significantly. So the challenge is that is faced in this is the bridge between the raw materials on the left-hand side and the products on the right-hand side. So you need primary metal and mill product technologies, and you need component manufacturing technologies. So this effort that we are putting in place to develop a titanium industry, therefore, is to see whether we can focus on the technologies that are needed to take the raw materials that we have in South Africa and convert them into the products that we envisage on the right-hand side. So we have this titanium COC to integrate and coordinate research and development activities in South Africa.
So this is the strategy that we are proposing. We want to move from the raw material into a range of products and components. The program is quite a long program. We hope to be able by 2018, this is the number that you see on the right-hand side, 2016, 2017, to be in a position to come back to you in 2017 with what this COC is going to deliver. But hopefully we will have a titanium incorporated industrialization plan. With a titanium industry. In between, we are going to give you a couple of. but the point really that we are saying is that this is a relatively long program. For instance, if one day we have the time today, we just want to share with you the concept. The major suppliers of titanium powder that meets the aerospace grade will be signing contracts, Imran, I think around about 2018, 2017. So by that time, we must have shown that we can take the raw material that we have in South Africa and we are able to produce the titanium powder that is of aero-grade standard. In order for us to do that, for instance, this is what we are trying to then do by pulling together a range of capacities in South Africa. We need simulation and modeling at the bottom. We need physical metallurgy of titanium. We need to have primary titanium metal production. We need to have powder-based processing of titanium. We need machining of titanium, investment casting, additive manufacturing of titanium, joining and forming of titanium. So we need all of these platforms, and this is what Steve was showing earlier on, with the platforms that have certain knowledge expertise, but it's only when you integrate all of these towards the technology that you want to develop and the industrialization process, including identifying the market and the suppliers that you need to work with in order to have a titanium industry. And we can give you some success stories that we already have at a presentation that you may ask us to do at some point around some of the successes that we have with some of these role players that we show in this COC that have already developed, I think, two patents, and they have started to develop some products. One of the products that consortium is developing, they were given a product by one of the aerospace companies, and they've been able to manufacture and cast that component for that aerospace company. We've been able to produce some products in the medical industry for hip replacement. Titanium is a very friendly metal with the body, so it's used quite extensively in things to make sure that your cheek, nose fixing, titanium is one of the important materials. So I think that's it, Stephen. I do like perhaps to go back to a few slides with your permission, Chair, just to put some more meat on what Stephen was saying. He talked, for instance, about this COC where we don't know the outcome. And yesterday, and I'm going to invite the members of the Portfolio Committee through you, Chair, we launched in one of the COCs for fuel cell and hydrogen at UWC this center of competence. And if you go there today, you will find approximately 30 master's and PhD students that are working in this work. They have been able to attract a private sector company from Germany called Fumatec that is working with them in the construction of membranes that are required in the fuel cell production. They have been able to develop a couple of prototype materials in the fuel cell that are needed for, or that could be used for heat and power applications. So when the COC was started, nobody had a clear sense of what those products are. But as I say, if you go there today, and this is only a three-year program, and they've been able to, as I say, identify a couple of products and a very nice patent portfolio that they are going to begin to use to negotiate with private sector partners, but they're beginning to commercialize this, and we'll be putting them in touch with the Technology Innovation Agency. This one, on Monday, the DST was visited by a consortium that includes Denel Aviation, that includes ATE, CSIR, and a number of universities to exploit South African capabilities to be utilized in unmanned aerial vehicle. We are targeting a less than 1% by 3-year market in this space. I think that translates into several billions of rand. I can't remember the numbers that they proposed. So $600 million in 3 years will be coming into this country when we export these UAVs for targeted markets that we have identified. So I thought I would just add this in order for you to get a crisp sense of the numbers and examples of some of these COCs. Thank you very much.
I think...
Thank you very much, DG. Some of the things, I think the oversight visits do help, because recently we were at CSIR, and so we're very familiar with the titanium importance and what it does. They showed us around at CSIR. Also, they also showed us around even the nanotechnology development there. Very interesting. It's just that after 2017 is not a good target for us. but anyway, I will allow members to interact with you. I have Honorable Smith there.
Yeah, Chair, thanks very much. I find it very exciting stuff. I'm really so happy that we're doing these things. But, so I just got a few questions. I mean, the first one is it's not clear to me what the sort of, from the point of view of some of the partners going into something like this, what the, let's call it the business model would be. I mean, there's no talk about the structure of the enterprise that does the commercialization and reaps the benefits from it. Is it a company? Is it a loose collaboration? You know, what are the models there? And then, of course, then how is the ownership determined? Who takes the lead? Well, in fact, the separate question would be, who takes the lead in the thing, in the actual commercialization of something? And you might have 20 partners in this thing. Is it driven by central management direction? You know, who gives direction? Who ensures that the thing is being driven effectively, instead of being so loose a collaboration that the collaboration falls to pieces? Then I was also interested in since the whole thing is geared towards commercialization of technology of one form or another, how that sits in with everybody else is doing the same thing. I mean, the CSIR does their own commercialization technology. We got the TIA, which has now been established, to do the same thing, although it has, I think, quite serious business problems. But is it anticipated that in a central competence that they would do their own commercialization, or is it anticipated that, you know, you bring in these other state-funded agencies automatically, or is it up to them, or what? How would that work? I was interested also in the nature of DST funding. I mean, when a thing like this gets together, how do you determine how much money to put into it, and what your share is of what might be a multi-partner collaboration? How does that all work? There was one slide we had a list of the areas where you have centers of competence, either established or being established. Just as a kind of rough figure, how many is this program anticipating being formed over what period of time? I mean, I didn't count them all, but it probably looked in the order of about 15, 20 there already, or maybe more. I'm not quite sure how many are anticipated. And I didn't see, it's just because there's only an example, I didn't see anything like ethanol, or I didn't see any energy things, actually. There were a whole lot of areas other than energy. Maybe I just missed that one. And then maybe just a thought. I know this is a new program for government in terms of this, starting now, going forward. But, I mean, can we really have we had seals in the centers of competence in the past? I mean, would you say, for example, the platinum industry with the catalytic converters, is that an example of a seal, you know, central competence we've had in the past which has worked, or is it sort of a separate kind of structure and model? Yeah, thanks.
Any other member who wants to have an input? If not, DJ, respond, please.
Thanks, Chair. Stephen is the expert here, so maybe I should do some and then ask him to help. Maybe let's start at the bottom. And the question, did we have these in the past? I don't remember. We might have had models where people work together in pursuit of certain capabilities that the country needed. I do know that in the nuclear energy, even though you had an organization which was called the Atomic Energy Corporation, AEC, that, you know, that entity was working very, very strongly with some of the universities that were actually doing whatever they were doing, but some of the students were actually graduating out of the work that they were doing at the Atomic Energy Corporation. If you look at the CSIR, when I was at WITS, for instance, doing my PhD, some of the material work that the students were doing at WITS, were characterization and some supervision was done at the CSIR. So you did have models of this nature. Perhaps they were not called the COCs. I do know that there was a strong partnership with the University of Stellenbosch in the defense industry, with the work that was done at the... So, you know, the work was something similar in terms of the concept, but maybe they were not called the COCs. On the... Maybe the second bullet point of your question four, that looks at how many and then the energy is missing. We are, I think, looking at the solar COC. We are of the opinion that the country needs to start looking together to exploit the technologies that would provide the best products in solar technologies. I know that the CSIR and Sasol, for instance, are talking about a concentrated solar plant that could be constructed in the Northern Cape. I do know that the CSIR at the moment is doing some work to measure the sun intensity in South Africa to identify various spots that would be better spots for using solar-related products for the conversion of sun into energy. So maybe we didn't talk about that specifically, but the one that I've invited the members perhaps to visit, the hydrogen one, it is an energy COC because the fuel cells are another alternative way of producing energy. In fact, part of the work in that regard, as you know, we've just signed a deal with an American company, Altigy Systems, together with Anglo Platinum and a technology innovation agency, where they will bring in the manufactured fuel cells for the distribution in South Africa and Southern Africa. But we would like to have a partnership with that consortium together with, for instance, the COCs in order for us to begin not only to just distribute the products that Altigy is making, but to draw on the existing capacities that we have at the Center of Competence at UWC together with the other one, which is at University of Cape Town and Mintec, because remember, you also need to know the catalysis process that helps you to split hydrogen into an electron and a positive so that you can get. So there's that center of competence. You also need to worry about the storage and the infrastructure for refueling. Stephen showed a nice bicycle which is hydrogen powered. So if you want to have these bicycles in the rural areas, when hydrogen runs out of the tank, who's going to make sure that there is infrastructure in the hydrogen to refuel this?
But, TG, our experience when we went on an oversight tour of Sweden, we found that the Swedes have gone very far than theoretical in fuel cell technology. And they found it very, very expensive, and they have abandoned it. They actually built three buses, which were hydrogen fueled. And they said it was the most expensive project. They simply insisted. They said, I was in CSIR during the last conference that we had. I asked them in CSIR. They said, indeed, it's very expensive. These are all the things that have got to be explored in fossil technology. It is promising, but the expense is too much. So I think we must also hit that.
Thanks, Chair. Two comments, perhaps. The first comment is that the fuel cells in the auto industry is something that we expect run about 2030 to 2050 to be comparable price-wise with the current technology. So I think the Swedes did a noble thing by recognizing that it's expensive. We all know that in the autos and the buses, and therefore fuel cells at the moment are being used in very, very targeted applications where the products are, if you like, comparable with the existing systems. If you go into the forklift industry, the fuel cell powers the forklift at a price that is competitive than how the forklifts are being powered at the moment. If you look at what is called uninterrupted power systems, which are needed as backup power for communication industry fuel cells. So when you do the strategy, don't get involved in areas where it's going to be competitive and you are not going to be able to take the market in. And if you then, my second point, if you visit this Hydrogen Center of Competence at UWC, they bought a product for combined power and heat system from an established manufacturer. And that product is 600,000 rands. And they try to reproduce that product with the knowledge that they have developed here. And they are able to produce the same product at 200,000 rands. So because of our knowledge in South Africa of catalysis, because of our partnership, strategic partnership that we formed, for instance, with this German company, Fumatec, we've been able to reduce the cost of what is called a membrane electrode assembly, because that is the heart of the fuel cell. If you are able to put less platinum, if you are able to distribute platinum, and this is the research that they are doing, together with, as I say, our knowledge of the platinum group metals that we have in South Africa, and these resources are here, we've been able to bring the cost down by a factor of one-third. So we can, we just need to be smart and be able to target those areas that make sense. Now, coming back to how many, Stephen, have you got an answer immediately? We probably are looking at between 10 and 15. But for us, it's not so much about the number, but it's about the fact that you are not creating these things from scratch. You identify areas where either investments have already been made, and all what you do, we say you're providing glue money. That takes capacities that you already have and how you take them into the next place. Just to give you an example, South Africa has, I don't know what size of the market, in the radio isotopes that are produced both at Nexa and at Itemba Labs. Now, those investments have already been made. The center of competence would be saying, if we look at nuclear technologies and their applications outside the nuclear, like in the radio and food, what is the size of the market and how can we bring Nexa together with the Itemba Labs to combine their capacities in order to exploit the market? So, again, because these things are not physical, you really are just having configurations that work to exploit a particular technology or capability. We really are not worried about the numbers, but how many of them would really deliver on these products? That is really what we will do. Now, the role of the DST is really twofold. One is to provide the strategic direction and to provide areas which we think there are opportunities. And in all of these areas, we've been able to do that, where partners sit and they don't realize that they have capacities which, if put together, they will be able to exploit a particular thing. this area of unmanned aerial vehicles, we invited the consortium members to the table, and we said, we know that you are involved in some kind of activities in unmanned aerial vehicles. We would like you to work together to exploit what we think is a potential vision. So I think, Imran, 2 years later or 3 years later, they have presented a very, very sizable business plan. They don't really tell us, of course, how, in fact, they did mention how thankful they were of the leadership that the DST provided, thought leadership around how they can work together. The second, of course, is to provide the funding, this glue funding, and also to be the ones who are the believers in this whole thing, because if you don't have believers in this game of technology development and exploitation, you tend to have cold feet when things don't work. So we are there to say, just get on, you're almost there. So we don't take share equity, but we do in an indirect way, but it's not the money that we take as government. We have, and this leads to your second question, we have the Technology Innovation Agency. We would hope to use it as a partner and as perhaps an implementing agency to help in identifying which of the products that are in the COCs are ready for commercialization, and therefore they would be working, visiting these COCs, trying to understand where they are, you know, whether they've passed the gates, different gates, in order for them, and then they would provide the funding, they would lobby funding from other partners. Just to give you an example, for instance, of something which is perhaps not a COC, but maybe it has the element of the COC, the Joule is something where we've been funding it. It's now reached a stage of commercialization. And the Technology Innovation Agency have been engaging with the IDC, and they've been able now to leverage almost 300 million rands from IDC for IDC to co-invest in the early stages of commercialization. We've been able to get the Eastern Cape Development Corporation to say, if you want to have a manufacturing capability, can you come to the ITZ and we would be partners? They are now going to be 18%. So it's that brokerage that then takes the things, which is very complicated, by the way, but I think there's another interesting story around this thing of commercialization and how the different role players, which we'll bring to your attention perhaps again when we maybe have a session to just show examples of how difficult it is to commercialize, but maybe some success stories. On the Innovation Fund project that was funded on this commercialization of photovoltaic research from UJ. And they are now on the verge of a very major breakthrough for the manufacturing of some of these solar panels from this research that came from UJ in South Africa and the revenues. Yes, so I think it's a very nice success story, but when you listen to both Professor Vivian Alberts, the vice principal, of the hurdles that they had to go through to get to this stage, both at the funding level and the games that, you know, the Germans are playing with them around dealing with these issues, it's a very interesting story, and maybe Chair was at the right place. So we play that role of just being there to support. The business model, they will differ depending on what the issue is. Now, in the case of, let me give specific examples. In the case of the fuel cell and hydrogen, we've yesterday, for instance, discussed that these technologies now need to be set up in the form of small startup companies. The university is exploring with the province and national government to have a land of an innovation hub that will sit alongside the university. So it's set up that spin-off company. But their focus is to produce these things, put them into marketplace, get the funding, and make revenues, hopefully export. However, they need the expertise at the university. So the business model will be a spin-off that is very, very close to the university. If the university wants to have ownership, if it thinks it will make some money, this is what we want as a state, so that the money that is invested in research comes into the university. So that model will be different. In the case of, for instance, the nuclear technologies, the model will be different because both Nexa and are, in a sense, government entities. but they may wish to set up maybe as part of themselves a private company that is owned maybe 40-50% by them jointly, and then find a private investor that would come in to also make sure. We think that's always the best model. Have a business partner that comes in who will say to the scientists, all Microsoft software that we have received, they are always having problems. Now, if Microsoft was run by scientists, we probably would still be on version one of Microsoft, because they want to debug everything until it's perfect. Doesn't work like that. You sell the product sometimes when it's in the marketplace. We've had in the automotive a number of recalls. Why do we have those recalls? Because people are fixing these things when the clients are actually testing them. So I think these models would be different depending on... Now, on the ownership, it's predominantly hub-and-spoke models. But we do like to identify in these centers of competence an institution that becomes the hub. And we are looking at perhaps identifying directors, people who will worry about all of the things that you talk about, IP issues, student training, funding issues, business model, where are we so that you are able to make sure that you run these things. In Finland, where they have something more or less similar, which they call centers of expertise, I think they have something that they call, is a term that they use, they wanted the innovation hub to, I've just forgotten the term. But this is, again, a person who acts like a broker, the glue that pulls the absolutely the center of competence together. Stephen, have I left anything? Okay, thanks.
I just have picked up something today, and in your explanation, especially on the nuclear field, we must be very careful, actually, in privatizing nuclear technology. I know that. You know how much the government has lost out from the PBMR project. And I know already now also that they are trying to bring it by another backdoor. And I have heard, actually, some people have even come to me to complain that the Department of Science and Technology is actually bringing this thing back by backdoor. Now I hear you talking a lot of... private nuclear technology working with universities, because that's the proposal of NORI, the NORI concept, and the unions are up in arms about that NORI. So be careful if you are an agent of NORI that you don't get caught up in the axis. I'm just warning you, because I know that they want to bring that PBMR by through NORI backdoor. You see, NORI is what they call the nation is a nuclear research institute, which should be attached to universities, but run privately, and then develop the nuclear IPs. And which were developed in PBMR. I know all that. So, are you answering that?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
I would just want to caution that the PBMR is a project aimed at building these pebble bed modular reactors, maybe something that is it's no longer a priority for the government. But there was a lot of IP that was generated. I mean, South Africa, in terms of nuclear technology, is world-class. The DG mentioned radioisotopes. We supply 70% of the world's radioisotopes, medical radioisotopes. And, in fact, recently there were a few factories that had problems, reactor problems, and South Africa was able to capitalize on that because we could increase our production capabilities more. So I wouldn't immediately throw out this. I don't know about this initiative. But as a DST, if there's useful IP that can be exploited for other means, radioisotopes or diagnostic equipment or whatever, then it's something we should be looking at. But not, I mean, PBMR was a very specific project. PBMR and nuclear, two different things. That's all I was cautioning about, because in the nuclear space, we are regarded as world leaders in many, many, many technologies.
Well, I happen to be a very well-trained nuclear scientist myself. And I happen to know very, very deeply about PBMR. Actually, what has happened now, I told them even before it happened.
Yes.
Now, the NURI concept, actually, what you're talking about, I can even answer you, this is what actually NASA has been doing. We are very good in radio nuclear technology through NASA. NASA has built very big capabilities, and so we don't need any NURIs for that. And the NURI in this context is actually nothing else but a vehicle for resuscitating PBMR by backdoor. With the creation of the National Energy SANEDI, under the National Energy Bill, there is no room for NURI because there is SANERI, there is SANEDI. There is all there's NEXA, there's CSIR. So where is the role of NURI, you see? So I just want to caution you, because these are matters that have, I have been approached by very senior people of government about it to advise. So, and then I heard that the DST is actually promoting this.
Chair, we categorically say we don't know what you're talking about, and we are happy to stand in a court of law and hold the Bible and say, so help me God, we don't know anything about it.
Maybe people
have approached the officials in the department, that's a different story, but it's not an official DST view. We've been asked to consider what should be done about the IP that has been generated within PBMR and how we could look at those skills and how we could use them for other nuclear-related activities. That's all what we are looking at.
Which is why I therefore come in there and say those things will be, they are very well placed under SANEDI. We don't need any extra NURIs, you see, because we've got a SANEDI which is exactly supposed to host all such things. That's why we developed this National Energy Act. It is exactly to do that, to centralize energy activity of South Africa so that we don't have these patches of NURIs and PBMR that eat the money of the states for nothing. See, I just wanted to warn you, because I am dealing with these issues now at the end, because they've learned the lesson, because I told them some of these things before, and now they have seen that I was talking sense, because I was talking from a professional point of view.
No, we check. No.
All right. I think with that, we have come to the end of this a good presentation, and thank you very much for coming and at least updating us and briefing us about where you are about the. Actually, I was always not sure what the difference is between the centers of competency and of excellence, because as I was saying, there are always. I could see that I can't hear myself very well. So there are always unnecessary duplication of these entities. At least we have to be sure what is the center of competency, or people are simply creating jobs for themselves. all those kinds of things. Yeah, actually, I was approached by the Minister of Finance to advise them what is the significance of this NURI. And I told them that there is no significance whatsoever insofar as I'm concerned. you know, because we've got all things that we've created now to host all these kinds of things. So we don't need any extra noise. Saneri. Actually, in Saneri, I had warned them. Saneri was also another kind of unnecessary thing that was created. And that is why it was sitting under Central Energy Fund, what for? You know? And the person who came with that, actually, Saneri started as Neri, if you remember very well. And when I questioned it, because I knew that Neri was an American program, you see, which I knew that by 2009 was supposed to be, converged back to the United States for 2010, start of what they call SMRs and MMRs. SMRs stands for medium modular reactors and small modular reactors, the technology that United States wanted to start from 2010, which is exactly what they are doing now. Now, when I questioned it, then it was changed to Saneri so that it has got the South African connotation. It was still Neri, but with South African prefix, South African Neri. That's how Saneri came about. And when I asked Rob Adam, why is Saneri under Central Energy Fund? He said, you know, we wanted it to be under CSIR, but I won't tell who said it should be there, you see. So, and so forth and so forth. Anyway, so we are learning, but I have questioned some of these things, but I became very unpopular those days. I'm now popular. Because I've been absolved. Right, thank you very much, honorable members and the chief of the delegation. We will meet again next time. But we're very happy to see. I think what we stressed with the minister in CSIR was that there are too many things, very, very big, important things that are happening. But there's no communication strategy, nothing. I think this is something that you have to work on. There are so many things, and that makes some of the things, the activity. You know, I was once a guest of the Minister of Nuclear Engineering in Taiwan. You know, one of the things they said South Africa has got very useful initiatives. But it doesn't have a strategy of collaboration and make its work very easy. They were mentioning even PBMR, that PBMR was a good project if it was properly managed, because it is a good project, by the way. It's what we call Generation 4 Initiative. But it was poorly managed, and that's why it has done what it has done, because it's a promising, it's a technology, very advanced technology, which has beaten Germans. That's why I studied about PBMR from... Actually, one of my papers I published, I was asked by the Georgia Institute to work with them to model the sphere packing factor of pebbles in the pebble bed. Because, that's one of the things that has been a problem in finding criticality of a pebble bed reactor, the packing factor of the sphere. So, and the sphere packing physics is very advanced. It's not for children. And I found them thinking that it is for children. You know. Anyway, that's good. Thank you very much.